Hello, and welcome to the New Art of the Cut podcast brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Nat Sanders, ACE, Elizabeth Reynolds' daughter, ACE, and Harry Yoon, ACE, about the latest entry into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Nat Sanders has worked with director Destin Daniel Cretton multiple times. I interviewed him before on their latest project together, Just Mercy. I also talked to Nat for his Oscar and Ace Eddie-nominated work on Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. Nat's other work includes If Beale Street Could Talk, among others. Elizabeth Reynolds' daughter started her editing career in her native Iceland more than 20 years ago. She's spoken with me on Art of the Cut about Mile 22 and Atomic Blonde. She's also edited The Deep, John Wick, and Deadpool 2, among others. Harry Yoon and I have spoken before for his most recent project, Minari, and for Best of Enemies. He's also been on other projects featured on Art of the Cut, including Last Black Man in San Francisco, First Man, Detroit, and The Revenant. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. We had some technical problems about getting Elizabeth on, so the first couple of questions don't include her. And the roofers decided to start work on Harry's house on the morning of this interview, so if you hear some hammering, that's it. Nat, you told me this great story about meeting this director who you've worked with numerous times at this point. Tell me about how you guys met, because I tell this story all the time.
Yeah, so my first feature was in 2007 or 8, Barry Jenkins' first feature. And I've been so hungry to break into the film industry. Before that, I'd been working in reality television, and I did Barry's movie for free. And I was so hungry to keep going. I did a couple more movies for free. And it took Barry quite a while to make his next film, which ended up being Moonlight. And so somewhere during those 8 years, I realized I needed some more directors to work with. And I started watching short films. There was a great quarterly DVD that put out. It was on Netflix from a company called Wolfen, where they would kind of curate the best shorts out of Sundance and South By and international festivals. So I just started watching all those. And I saw a short called Short Term 12 that really blew me away. It was so emotional and raw and real, and I loved it. So I, you know, looked up the director, stalked him a little bit online. I happened to see that he had edited the short himself, which, you know, is always a little bit of an opening. Sometimes I feel like directors, more often than not, they would like to work with an editor in those cases, but maybe, you know, they didn't know someone that they trusted with it, or they felt like, I don't have any money, so is someone going to be able to do this as dedicated as I would be if they're working for free and kind of doing it on the weekends? And so he'd cut it himself, did a great job. There was potentially a little window there, and I just happened to see him the next year at Sundance, and I made a beeline up to him, told him how much I loved his short, and just kind of tried to jam my foot in the door. And he happened to have seen some of the films that I had worked on, and we got lunch and just kind of kept the conversation going. And the next year he made Short Term 12 the feature, and I did that with him, and it's kind of been off to the races since.
I think those directors that are cutting shorts, they're there. They want to talk to people after their film shows. They're happy to chat with just about anybody. And like you said, if the guy edited his own movie, chances are that he would probably like to have another voice, another editing voice.
I found it to be the very opposite of dating. With dating, you need to play it cool and you need to kind of pretend like you don't care. But I always found when going up to directors whose work I admired, that it's just, they want to work with people who are passionate about their work and their vision. And so I always vomited out my admiration for them and tried to shove my foot in the door. And it worked a couple times. Yeah.
I love it. Terry, you and I have talked for some projects that are very different from this one, Minari in the past and Best of Enemies. And you even got a mention, I don't know if you know this, by Stephen Mirioni on The Revenant.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah. He's been a longtime mentor. So it's great to hear that.
So how did you end up on this project?
I feel incredibly lucky to have joined this team after they finished their director's cut. And it was largely because there was such a delay during production due to COVID. So that pushed post out far enough where, unfortunately, Elizabeth needed to leave for her next film. And so she started on the project from principal day one with Nat, and then they stayed in Sydney for over a year, like cutting dailies and ultimately the director's cut. And when it came time for them to come back to the States, they needed to leave for her next film. And so they needed a second editor. You know, as everybody knows, the workload on a Marvel film is pretty significant. And so thankfully, there was about a month of overlap during the beginning of Producer's Cut, where the three of us got to really put our heads together and begin that brainstorming process of like what's working, what's not working, what could be more clear, and really began that process of experimentation together. And then I took over for Elizabeth when she had to leave for her next show.
Talk to me about the evolution and what you guys talked about to be able to get yourself to the heart of the story as quickly as possible.
We had many, many discussions about it. And I did some flashback. Me and Nat sat down and talked about it and did some more tests. And then we introduced it to Destin, who fell in love with it. And he took it further. He just made us do flashbacks all the way through the movie, which was great. We loved that idea.
Everything that you see in the past actually was front-loaded in a very long prologue. That whole backstory, and I don't want to say any spoilers here, but you know, a lot of the things that you see later on in the film were actually front-loaded up front. And what was interesting was I didn't see any of that. You know, one of the reasons that the team thought it would be very useful for me to come on at that point was they had done this like amazing restructuring, but they didn't have fresh eyes that didn't know the story, didn't know the script. And so I came at it completely fresh, like as if I was an audience seeing it for the first time. What was remarkable was that the vast majority of that restructuring felt like that's the way that the script was written. And so that, you know, that's a testament to the work that Elizabeth and Nat and Destin had done through the director's cut, was to make it feel seamless. And there's still cuts today. It just feels like so perfect that flashback lands when it does. That structure was very much in place. With the reaction that I had, then beginning a discussion of like, okay, well, how can we keep refining further the front of the movie? And then, you know, ultimately where we go to, how do we refine the flashbacks a little bit more so that we show just enough and no more. That was where the discussion was once we started up in January.
When you see the film put together, you realize that as good as the script was, something else has to happen. And that just fascinates me that, you know, that old saying about there's the story you write, the story you shoot, and the story you edit. And they're all three totally different movies.
It's a completely different medium to tell a story. So obviously it's not going to be the same. It doesn't mean it's not important in the script, because without it in the script, the actor might not have given that look. You know what I mean? It's just a different medium to tell the story. So, and we would be useless if it didn't need any help once we get, we wouldn't have a job. So I'm very happy that we get to work on this way of telling this.
And knowing that about the flashbacks, that they were all really kind of front loaded, how do you decide where to drop each flashback in it?
Initially, between me, Nat, and Destin, I love those scene cards. You get like a card with an image for every scene, and we would do the first pass just on the wall, like a puzzle, which it is, and discussing like how much do we want to know at one point. And like Destin, he liked this a lot, because when we get to the village, we kind of knew everything. So what could we move up and reveal in the village to make his journey there more effective?
Moving things around, talking was definitely the first phase, kind of doing that paper edit and talking through what are the good ramifications of this? Are there any downsides? But, you know, and this was all done in a relatively short amount of time. You know, normally a director's cut would be, I believe, maybe 10 weeks normally before you'd kind of have to show the producers of the studio, give or take. In this case, it was 6 weeks. That's just the way Marvel works. Kevin and Lou and Victoria are really part of the creative process. And so you show it to them pretty early before you've gone down too many paths and tried out too many things so they can be a part of it.
Yeah, I think, Steve, like just circling back to one of the things you said about the difference between, you know, the story on the page, the story that's shot, and the story that in the cutting room, especially in terms of something like a Marvel film, like an origin story, there's so much mythology and world creation that's happening. There's like an explanation of powers, particularly of this like new artifact. What are the 10 rings? How do they get their powers? How do they empower Tony Leung's character and Simu Liu's character? so much of that explanation is you have to sort of get everybody to understand it who's about to shoot the movie, right? And then you have to get everybody as trying to sort of live it out as they're shooting the movie, particularly with like super complex like stunt work, like the fight scenes in this. And like, so you're focused on so many different goals. And by the time it gets to us, we're like, okay, we have all of this explanation. We have all of this world building. It's a little bit too much if we put it all on screen. And so like, what can we take away so that that world building and that mythology creation still feels clear to the audience and satisfying to the audience and ultimately grounded in the characters that hopefully the audience is falling in love with? It becomes this really interesting exercise in removing some information here and some exposition here, and then adding little bits of exposition here and there so that it feels organic to that kind of emotional story that's being told. Because I think the demands of something in the MCU is like, there's so much, you know, you have to understand in terms of powers and things that are beyond, I think, central relationships like father, son, or brother, sister, you know, those are the things that you're normally trying to really tease out. But in addition to that, you're saying like, how do these powers work? How does this character that seems out of nowhere, how do they fit within this story? And to try to do that kind of organically, that becomes a really wonderful kind of puzzle to solve.
How did you guys collaborate as the film started to evolve?
Well, me and Nat spent the most time doing this, and we did kind of pick scenes, but it depended on the shooting. And then we did a lot of talking, and we actually worked really well together. I'm very proud of my collaboration with Nat. It really went well, where we would sometimes watch each other's scenes. It only happened once. We were going to do this weekly, Nat, but it only happened not once, where we went down to the cinema to watch what we've done. Mm-hmm. But we talked about it, and then scenes went back and forth.
None of you guys had previously worked with a lot of editors as a group, correct?
Yeah, I think the most recent thing was probably coming off of First Man as an additional editor with Tom Cross and John Cho. Yeah, so that was an experience in sort of understanding how to divide the film. For that film, it was a little bit all over the place. We were kind of touching every scene at different times. For me, once I came on, all the scenes were done, all the things were built, except for the stuff we shot during additional photography. And pretty organically, I think Nat and I decided just to cut the movie in half, where he took the first half of the movie and I took the second half of the movie. I don't know if we always intended for that to be a permanent thing, but like once we were on the wild ride, that is like basically the producer's cut, which is you preparing for audience screenings, doing notes, brainstorming, preparing for audience screenings, and preparing for additional photography, we pretty quickly realized like there's no way that we could, you know, move beyond that division.
Later in the process, it did become pretty necessary to have the VFX team to just kind of be able to know, okay, this shot is in reels 1 through 5, then we'll go to Nat with that one, and this one's in reels 3, 6 through 10, we'll go to Harry with this. It would get pretty complicated if you were still interweaving each other's work pretty dramatically at that point. But I still don't know how other people do it. I would love to find out from other editors how you split things up. But in our case, it was just on a day-to-day basis as scenes came to us, and we'd say, you know, I'll take these 3 scenes. How about you take these 3? And we would just kind of try to always be fair and equitable in how we'd split them up during the shoot. And then once Harry came on, everything started to get, in a good way, everything got switched up. I don't know if there's any scene in the movie that didn't get touched by at least 2 of the 3 of us, but it's always great to get other people's input, and everything kind of got touched by someone else in a really good way.
One of the things that I thought of a couple of times was the trickiness of some of the tonal shifts. Talk to me about trying to balance that, especially as you start to drop scenes that maybe were giving you some space or some connection between those tonal shifts.
Well, yeah, there are many things you have to balance in a movie. It's the story, but also you don't want to overshadow certain moments.
You know, one of the interesting things that Nat and Destin early on were balancing, and I think we kept recalibrating through the process, was the relationship between Katie and Shang-Chi early on. You know, you wanted to get the sense that they were really close friends, but you also wanted to introduce characters that were kind of carefree. You definitely wanted to showcase Awkwafina's, you know, incredible humor and spontaneity, but not in such a way where you were distracting from who the hero of the story was. That was definitely something that I think we went through a number of rounds on. And I think this is one of the hallmarks of the Marvel process, is that we did a lot of audience screenings. We ended up doing 2 or 3 times as many as like I'm normally used to, but it was incredible as a resource, because we could sort of do these kind of like more finely tuned calibrations and get almost immediate feedback on some of those things. I think that process lends itself to sort of that fine tuning that you're talking about is getting so much good feedback from our audiences.
So yeah, so we did 6 previews. The first 3, as Harry said, were remote and it was difficult. You know, you're looking at people in masks on night vision camera and you're like, oh, did they smile there? And you heard the movie louder than you heard them. So you like, did that get a laugh? It was difficult to ascertain what we wanted to, even though, as Harry said, the cards and the focus group were really helpful. And then we went to additional photography and then we did 3 more afterwards. And for those 3 screenings, we were able to be there and it was incredibly helpful.
Is there a difference between fights in the movie? Like some of them felt that were circular motion was a big thing, and there's other martial arts that are very direct and hard martial arts. Did you try to have different fights have different personalities?
So many fights are homages to other, I think, kung fu styles and traditions that we've seen cinematically. It's just like this beautiful introduction to the variety of styles that we've seen. There are a number of different styles that are kind of grounded in different characters too, and in the situations. And so there are homages to a lot of those cinematic forebears in terms of kind of a beautiful kind of kung fu choreography that we've seen before. One of the advantages where a lot of stuff is shot in blue screen is that you could really sort of extract some moves from where they were originally used and then use them in a different context, especially if you're trying to compress time or if you're trying to bridge certain bits of choreography later on in the process. Ultimately, that kind of blue screen shooting technique can end up giving you some tools that you might not have if things were shot normally. So
I'm just thinking of one scene, is the bus scene. You know, I think when that scene first came together, it was over 8 minutes and it was all great, but we knew it really should be around 6 minutes. So how do we condense it? But you know, the fight goes from this part of the bus to this part of the bus to this part of the bus, which is really exciting, but it also makes it an interesting challenge to condense it, but you're only in this one area for 20 to 30 seconds. And so you can't just all of a sudden, you know, jump from the front of the bus to the roof. So how do you still make it really clear and cohesive, but find ways to keep the pace up to where we all are going to want it to be? And those were the fun challenges. And also interweaving things like losing jokes. And that scene in particular is one where I think in the script, there were great lines, really funny lines that we were all excited about. But once we started putting it together, you realize the more you cut away from the action, from the fighting, the more it's dragging, but let the action lead the way.
Did either one of you two pick up any great fight editing tips from ER?
One of the great things about this film is you mentioned the tonal shifts is that, you know, we do have action scenes, we have comedy, we have emotional drama. And it was really refreshing and great to be able to interweave all of those scenes. And it's not like one of us did one aspect of it and the other, everyone did everything. But with those fight scenes, I didn't have a background in that. So I really was leaning on Elisa Ben. I would recommend this to anyone in a similar position. I was going in early on and looking at her timelines and seeing the little tricks and maneuvers she was doing and learning from that. I would see, oh, in this one moment, stunt work here is great, but this one part of the movement was a little too slow. She hit a little speed ramp here. How fast did she make the speed ramp? Oh, okay, I see how she did that in a way that made it totally seamless to where you would never notice that she had hit something there. Just all these little tricks, without a doubt, was stealing looks at ER's timelines and finding ways to do that myself.
It was like so nerve-wracking, like with the prospect of touching any of ER's action scenes. I really resisted modifying anything early on in the process. It was only like towards the very, very end, you know, we're getting down to sort of the last minute stuff that, you know, I thought to change it because they were just so beautifully done and musical, rhythmic, and it really showcased again the choreography that we're all singing the praises of. On a personal note, I usually am not that precious about sort of like recutting something, but that was definitely one of those things where I was just like, oh man, I don't want to like disturb the harmony of what's already there. So
right, but the trick, as you said, is sometimes you're like, oh, we got to cut 2 minutes out of this fight. What do you do?
Well, I think that's one of the things that really struck me as being refreshing about the brainstorming and collaborative idea generation process that the Marvel Trio really brings into place. It feels like everything's on the table, and that kind of fearlessness with the material was a wonderful part of the process for me. I think that's why the movies get refined in a really amazing way through the cut.
Elizabeth, you mentioned that many of the fights had VFX components that made it tricky. How do you even pace a scene if there's rings flying around through the air that you can't even see?
Well, that's something we all have. It's called imagination, and you just have to like imagine it and time it. The actors and stunt people were always there, but yeah, there were rings added and all kinds of girls, and it was a bit of a challenge just to follow through the whole time and like make sure that you weren't going ahead of visual effects and keep them in the loop the whole time, because they were working really fast. So you had to really make sure all your timings were well done as possible, because they would take them and just finished them. Like, he was just like, whoa, okay, just make sure your timings are there because they're going to take it away. And that was true. They did. They worked really fast.
Yeah. Our VFX editors became very helpful with that back and forth between us and the VFX department. And in particular, when Ed Marsh came on the show as our VFX editor, it was a really great middle person to be able to communicate when we are using our imagination, for us to be able to tell Ed, this is what we're thinking for this, and work it out with him. And then he goes to our VFX supervisors, you know, Chris Townsend, to communicate what our intention was with it. And we could hear from him that maybe he was thinking the same thing or thinking something differently. And we could kind of work together that way. But in those cases, you do have to work with the VFX department pretty closely.
Spent a lot of time with Ed Marsh. Yes.
I was thinking about the amount of management that has to take place just by editors, the amount of management in VFX.
With the number of audience screenings we had, of so many things working in parallel, particularly sound editorial, the mix, color, etc., the amount of coordination and turnovers that we needed to have. I mean, if we didn't have a top-notch crew, I think we would have been completely lost. Definitely kudos to them. In terms of coordination with visual effects, this team brought us so much joy. They're the veterans. They're the ones that have been through 4 or 5 Marvel films already. And we're talking about the visual effects supervisor, visual effects producers, you know, all the coordinators. You could tell because they all have the best swag, you know, like they all have like the cool jackets and like sweatshirts and hoodies and stuff like that. They're incredible the way that they are able to communicate these volumes of notes and the meetings that we have and all the changes that they're able to kind of pivot on. And that's the one thing that was really striking about working in post on a Marvel film, was like so much of your day is taken up by VFX reviews. So much of what's happening in visual effects and the decisions that are being made, the kind of, especially the creative decisions, the rhythmic decisions, the timing decisions, really have an impact on your cut. All of that time was absolutely necessary, that back and forth and that creative conversation.
And to finish talking about our team, just to give credit to the few remaining assistants who didn't get mentioned, I think there was also Luca Byrne, Max Fisher, ER mentioned you,
yeah,
Adama Fire and Palm. And for me personally, working on smaller films before this, and I didn't come up as an assistant, I wish I had. For me, it was a real education on how to utilize such a huge team and how to delegate, like especially with sound work. I love working with sound and music in the temping process, but in this case, there's just no time. There's too much else going on. And so our sound team, in particular, Matt and Luca, while we were in Sydney, did a ton of our sound work that really laid the template for where the mix ended up going. And we really put that on their shoulders, and they did an incredible job.
When you're cutting dailies and looking at the setups that you have available to you, how do certain angles or shot sizes speak to you for different moments of a story or a scene?
It is a bit of a dance. And I think when I try to watch the dailies through the first time with just watching them as an audience member and letting them wash over me, and as that's happening, somewhere in the back of your brain, you're maybe thinking, you know what, this is the type of scene where maybe I want to start this way. And then this beat is really where the scene turns. And so I want to emphasize that beat and that moment by going in close at that moment or whatever the case is. And you kind of start to work out the dance in your head as you're watching. And then I'll go through the dailies a second time and really start making those decisions at that point. And it's the kind of thing where you really need to see the space that they're in. So, okay, obviously you should start on a wide because you need to see the space for this reason or that, or maybe you don't need to see the space. And so, or maybe you want to withhold that. And so you don't show the wide at the beginning.
That's one of the reasons I like to watch dailies in a string out, because it's often the time between takes where like, I'm not just sort of like in front of my seat watching what's going on, but almost sort of having that time to digest what I just saw. So letting all that sort of rollout happen and all of the prep happen before the next slate, that time as I'm sort of rolling through actually gives me time to be like, oh, I wonder if like that gesture is a really important gesture. Or I wonder if they're going to change the blocking here because this bit of dialogue seemed too awkward, or this two shot definitely is not working for this moment. So I can probably throw out, you know, most of this until we get to this line. There's all that kind of passive thinking versus active viewing that I think is like really important to give yourself space as.
Yeah. And I also think it's important to know that even though you read the script, you might have watched tons of stunt ways, et cetera, you're still getting to know the movie when you watch the dailies. So sometimes I throw a scene together and then pick it up the next week, because after a week of viewing, I know so much better where I want to be in that scene than I might know the first day I get. Mm-hmm. So it's also just being patient, like learn the film.
Performance does, in the hierarchy of your decisions, performance is at the top. And so, you know, there might be cases where you've gone halfway through the scene, you've gone into close-ups and you would love to stay in close-ups, but you know, the performance isn't there for this line that that you need it to be. And so you need to, maybe you need to go out to a medium or go wider. And, you know, for me, I try to find a way to make that seem like an intentional choice. Maybe you have to work backwards and be like, you know, okay, I'll introduce going to this wider angle a hair earlier. And you know, it's always a dance and you try to make it feel very elegant and intentional always.
Near the end of the film, there are some scenes that are completely CG. Were you guys using previs for that stuff? Is it more like animation editing to do those kind of scenes or no?
No, not really, because it's still actors based. Even though there is a CG creature, you still have actors, and then maybe you cut to it or something, but we had prefaces to work with.
Because it requires much more rudimentary renderings of characters, that by definition, the kind of lighting, the kind of emphasis that really impacts editorial choices, there's elements involved like water or wind or like vapor or things like that, that you can't see in previs and that would impact your editorial choices. So it is definitely this kind of brinksmanship where you're like, I think it will be this way, you know, and you're trying to, as Elizabeth said, like your greatest tool is your imagination. You know, it really helps to have gone through the VFX process to know that what you see in previs is definitely a rendering of action, but it's not a complete rendering of action, particularly when it comes to clarity. And so that becomes really challenging. And it's very, very helpful to have a good team, like a really good VFX team, to give you a sense of like, when are we going to actually see the shot or a better rendering of the shot? And also super critical is to have a schedule in place where you're not locked into things because of delivery schedules. I mean, these shots take so much time and so much power to render. In fact, like our VFX producer said at one time, we were like one of the highest power consumption entities in all of New Zealand or something like that because of the render farms that were rendering these incredibly complex shots at Weta. And so they take so much time that you want to at least have a little bit of wiggle room to trim or to extend or to, you know, maybe go a different direction if something's obviously not working. So it becomes really nuanced towards the end.
And there are so many shots and scenes that are going to be so time consuming on the VFX side that pretty much right from the beginning of production, Damien Carr, VFX producer, you know, came to us and gave us a list of, okay, in this month, you're going to need to turn over this many shots and we turn over. And, you know, he's so busy, we're barely seeing him. They asked for maybe 60% confidence that the shot will be in the finished movie. And if it was one that you weren't confident or you felt like in the back of your mind, we're probably going to lose this scene, you would hold off on turning those over. So we would have to bring Destin over and tell him what VFX is requesting and make sure that we had the takes and timings that he also agreed with. And there were definitely moments early on where Yara and I were concerned about the possibility that we would get locked into things that in the end wouldn't be the best thing for the movie, but we'd gone down such a long road with the VFX wise. And I have to say to what Harry mentioned earlier, that was not, ended up not being a concern at all in the end. You know, there were big, big things that we ended up throwing out late because it wasn't the right thing for the movie and we pivoted and did something else instead. And so it really is all about story and what's the best thing for the movie. And that was definitely a relief. Yeah, yeah. Scenes or events or just things that where we found out through previewing, this isn't quite working even. And in some cases they were very effects laden sequences. And there was no hesitation that if it wasn't quite working, wasn't the right thing for the movie, even though VFX had been working on for 8 months and I don't even want to know how much money had been spent on it then.
And personally, like you don't see the names of ACs or camera operators or production designers on particular shots in dailies. So when you lose those shots editorially, you're like, oh, like it's like this kind of abstract, like, oh, the crew worked on this. But like there are shots that you know, because like on the slate for visual effects shots, they often have the name of the artist on there. And so like you kind of know that like Joe, whatever, right? Like worked on this shot for like months. And so you feel like an extra pang of guilt to know that like, oh no, but if we cut this, then like all of those months of work are gonna, you know, not be seen by the audience. But like you still have to make that decision. That makes it personally like extra hard, is to start to see the names of the people whose work you're leaving on the cutting room floor. So apologies to all those amazing artists that unfortunately didn't necessarily make the final cut, but their work consistently was really remarkable.
That's awesome. Well, I know that you guys are all in demand and have other things to be doing today. I really appreciate the time that you spent with me and thank you so much for talking about this movie. It was really an exciting little ride.
Nice seeing you again.
Always.
Yeah. Great talking to you again.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Experience. Thanks to my guests, Elizabeth Ronaldsdotter, ACE, Harry Yoon, ACE, and Nat Sanders, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram @StevHallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember, if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.